I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. A dedication is a common way to show admiration for someone, unless you're pianist Steven Spooner. Today, Spooner shares how and why he spent 19 months pulling together 16 CDs worth of recordings, paying homage to his musical inspirations. Then, more than 100 marches will take place in America on Saturday, all in the name of science. One is scheduled for here in KC, with more than 1,000 people expected to attend. We'll find out why some think the role of science is under threat. Later, the latest edition of State House Blend, Missouri. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. In September, KU piano professor Steven Spooner released a 16-CD set of recordings paying tribute to his musical inspirations, ranging from 19th-century composers to Van Cliburn and Queen's We Are the Champions. Its title, Dedications. His emphasis, though, is in the Russian school, Horowitz and Richter, because Spooner studied in the former Soviet Union. The compilation has been getting strong reviews, and Spooner was invited to give a lecture and concert at Juilliard in February. Steven Spooner joins us right now, and welcome.
Hi.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
16 CDs. What were you thinking? That's a lot of CDs.
It almost killed me.
It was
sort of a marathon event, but yeah, it's good to be on the other side.
What made you think that a 16-CD project was worth your time? It didn't start out that way.
No, it started out smaller, but the centennials of Sviatoslav Richter in 2015 and Emil Gilels, two of my favorite pianists, in 2016, they focused me in a way to say that, okay, if I'm going to do a project to commemorate their memories, I have to do something akin to their legacies. And Richter had the largest repertoire of any pianist. So that was one thing that really inspired me. If I was going to dedicate something that sort of encapsulated his art form, I needed to do something grand.
I can't remember exactly, but I think you started off thinking three or four discs, and then suddenly it was growing larger. Did somebody ever stop you along the way and said, Steven, what in the world are you doing? this is getting away from you.
Actually, it was intended to be larger. I made recordings of the Diabelli variations of Beethoven and Schumann Fantasy, which did not pass muster, among many other little pieces.
Whose muster did it not pass?
Mine.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were cut from the program. It could have been upwards of 18, 19 CDs.
I read that you tried each piece, played it three times, and if you weren't satisfied at the end of three, that piece got jettisoned.
That's right. That is how recording artists of a bygone era used to make recordings. I believe that all of this extra studio time that pianists have in the modern age with lots of digital editing actually produces a perfect, though very sterile, product.
Huh.
And I wanted to get away from that. Richter made what is still the most lauded recording of the Brahms Second Piano Concerto when he was on tour in America. And the recording time was just enough to play through the piece once and to catch some spots. They didn't even play it twice. And I think there's something to be said for that level of immediacy and freshness. And that's what I wanted to try to recreate.
I was so struck here. Obviously, as I've mentioned, you've picked composers ranging from Horowitz to Queen. I mean, really?
Well,
why Queen? That's
a great question. You know, Mr. Horowitz was so famous for his transcriptions of things that the audience would know, like Stars and Stripes, that he made famous arrangements of. And, you know, when Horowitz would play in Carnegie Hall in the 40s and 50s, his encores were known by more than half the audience. So there are recordings where he goes out, he plays a single note, and half the audience laughs.
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't happen anymore. Because our audiences are open to a whole range of music. So I thought, if Mr. Horowitz were alive today doing the same thing, would he make transcriptions of Stars and Stripes? I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
I think he would do something more akin, more closely aligned to the everyman. And I thought, what things would almost everyone know? And I thought, okay, that's perfect.
You know, describe for us, if you would, Stephen, the reactions you're getting from critics all over the world and from others as well, because I know it's been pretty gratifying. Tell me about the review you just got that opened up with someone writing, when I first saw the 16-CD box set, I thought, whoa, or whatever the line was.
Yeah, the American Record Guide, which I was very grateful for, actually said that they thought it was a hoax.
Nobody would do something like this.
Exactly. And, you know, that's exactly what I wanted to do, because a few years ago, there was a hoax in Piano Records where a record producer who was confronted with the sort of untimely death of his wife put out this box set of her recordings. And it turned out to be all recordings of different pianists. And the critical reception of this was immense. You know, she was on the cover of International Piano.
Oh,
and
wow.
Everybody wanted to review her. So one young critic at the time, it was about 20 years ago, was putting the CDs into iTunes. And iTunes was correctly identifying who recorded the music. So the first line of that review was, "Is this Joyce Hatto?" Again, and that was the name of the pianist, because – and that's exactly what I wanted. I wanted to put out this statement, a large artistic statement that seemed to, you know, really push the boundaries of what is might be artistically possible.
Why did you want to – why was that important to you?
Well, it's like a great act of self-improvement. You know, being a musician is not about – I think it's not about a career in music. It's about dedicating your life to something.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was important. I thought this project could improve me. It could deepen my relationship with the music. It could deepen my mastery. And so that's why I did it.
How much time did you spend on this?
It was hours. I mean, especially post-production. That's the longest part. The recording itself didn't take that long.
Why is the post-production part of it the longest? I don't understand how records are made.
Because I'm a control freak.
Oh, really?
I don't let a producer, and many were willing to do it, listen and select the takes. I select the takes.
Because?
Because only I know what I want.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's your name on the cover.
Yeah, so I selected all the takes that I wanted to use, and that takes a long time.
How did you decide, you know, what you were going to try to record here? What was your process that you went through?
It's interesting. I only played it three times with what I call spots, you know, difficult places. And so after those three times, I would listen dispassionately, usually checking email. And the only thing that I was searching for was freshness. And if you read through Richter's diaries, it's the biggest thing that he regrets. all throughout his diaries, he said, I listened to my recording. I'm so disappointed because there's no freshness. It's a perfect recording, but it doesn't capture me.
And freshness to you means what?
Artistically alive, not being safe, not just executing the notes in a technically proficient way. Some sense of communication.
And maybe some sense of imperfection occasionally?
Imperfection is important, especially risk. Horowitz said it. I mean, Horowitz was a genius at recording. And he said, I always leave a few wrong notes in my recordings, especially in moments of great climax, because the audience must feel the sense of risk.
Oh, that's so interesting. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're visiting with KU piano professor Stephen Spooner, who's just issued a 16-CD box set. It's titled Dedications to the People Who Have Inspired Him Over the Years. What kind of impact did Van Cliburn have on you? He's from your native Louisiana, Steve, and he shocked the world by winning the inaugural Tchaikovsky competition back in 1958. It was a huge event around the world when that happened. Tell me about Van Cliburn and your life.
It's actually very close to me, because when I was a little kid, I was starting to get interested in piano. As I like to say, that before my hobby was piano, my hobby was beating up kids who played piano. And once I was stung with the enthusiasm of playing and about piano, which came through records, I went to my school library. And I asked the librarian if there were any books on pianists, and he gave me the Van Cliburn Legend, which documents how he got started and his life up to the competition. Hmm. That book, to say that that book was an influence on me is a major understatement. And it was through that book that I decided that if I wanted to make this a career goal, then I myself needed to go to Russia, as he did. He went to Russia for the competition, but his teacher, Rosina Levine, was one of the most famous Russian pedagogues in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so as I went through my life, I had many great opportunities to meet Mr. Cliburn, but the best one was last, because as a student in Russia, my favorite thing was to go to the conservatory library and listen to recordings. And there were lots of recordings that we didn't have in America. There were radio broadcasts, live things, and they were all of Cliburn. And when I came back to the state, I bought a bunch of these albums and I shared them with some friends. One of my friends happened to be Cliburn's first cousin.
Mm.
He sent the albums to Cliburn himself. And the next time I met Cliburn, which was at the Cliburn competition, he said, you're Steve. Okay. Can I take you to dinner? We went to dinner.
You're kidding.
No. We went to dinner because I asked him, would you sign my book again? And I studied in Russia. And immediately he put it together. And he said, tell me, what are the other recordings over there? And his assistant made a big list of all the things that I had found. And I think he did the legwork. And after that time, they released some albums, rediscovered in Russia and things like that.
How old were you when you went over to the former Soviet Union to begin with?
I was 20, almost 21.
And you wanted to go just because Van Cliburn had done it, or it was a step you knew you had to take artistically?
Well, I say it like this, that if you're an aspiring basketball player anywhere in the world, you want to be in America, where the level of basketball playing is the best. One could say that the level of piano playing is the best in Russia. And I had the great fortune of sort of running into my teacher while he was on tour in America. And through that experience, through having a master class with him, I knew I had to, risk it and make the move.
How difficult of a transition was that going to Russia with the language challenges and with you wanting so desperately to become the artist you wanted to become?
It was hard. And the reason it was hard is because I lived through the Georgian Civil War, which, though it was a great toll, and I mean toll like we didn't have food and my mother didn't recognize me when I got off the plane after the first year.
Really?
The artistic value far outweighed those risks.
In what sense? I mean, why?
Well, I mean, the dedication. You see, that's what the Russian school offers. They offer the dedication to one's art. It's hard to describe. They're
meaning they're all in a way that we're not over here?
I think so. At least what I experienced with my teachers. Of course, there are many teachers in America who, of course, preach the same gospel. But there one feels it, and also one feels that there is a great body of listeners who is expecting it, which is a little different.
Yeah. Well, Steve, we have a problem here because you're not only a great player, you're a great talker, and we haven't played enough of your music yet. So let's rectify that right now. Let's play a little bit of Stephen Spooner playing Queen. This is the song, We Are the Champions. You know, it's an amazing piece, but why did you pick it?
Well, it was a piece that I knew that would resonate with audiences everywhere. I remember when I first started playing it, the backstage crew at a place, I was playing in Georgia, and they were like, are you playing that tonight? And I said, yeah. And they said, I think I'll come to this concert.
Really?
I've never been to a concert in this hall. I only work the backstage crew.
Because you knew you could connect with people in a way that maybe they hadn't been connected with before. That's part of it?
Well, you see, the thing that Horowitz did was that when he played his arrangements, he brought people into the hall who would really not be there, and then they kept coming back.
Huh. You also, this set is mostly solo work, but you also work with a string quartet on Brahms' Piano Quintet in F minor. Tell us about the quartet that plays Brahms' quintet.
Well, the Borromeo String Quartet, I think, is recognized as one of the finest in the world. They're a resident quartet at New England Conservatory. But we're really fortunate at KU to have a really wonderful friend in Reach Out Kansas, the foundation, Jim Zakura, and they bring all these great guest artists to school, leading pianists and pedagogues and stuff like that. And Borromeo came and we played together, and I was doing this project and I thought, why don't we record this if you guys are up for it? So
you made a real point of telling them, I saw this in the video last night, that we're going to play this as equals. Tell me why that was important for you to say that, and oftentimes, is it unequal in some way?
Yeah, because the pianist just plays like a jerk most of the time, and they just play like a concerto all the time. And even pianists that I really admire, they play in a way that everything that they do is the solo. And it doesn't quite work that way in that piece. There are many, many times for all of the instruments to shine. So they were so experienced. And that was the other thing. Pianists, when they play with a quartet, they're kind of, I hate to say, they're a little bit dictatorial. And they say, well, this is the tempo. And because the piano part is so big, it's like a concerto part almost. But I figured, okay, in my whole life, I probably will play this piece, I don't know, 15 times. I don't know. And probably with just a few groups. And I asked them before we started, how many times have you guys played this? And they said some staggering number, like, we've played this with at least 70 or 80 different pianists. So I thought, okay, you guys know the piece much more than I do. You have much more time investment. So tell me all of the little things that you always annoyed you when you play with pianists. And so I managed.
What kinds of things did they say?
Well, like, I really learned, like, the violist was playing this line and she stopped and she goes, you know, I really hate when pianists play with pedal, as you are doing right now in that spot, because I think the composer is saying this about the next movement. And I thought, wow, that's wonderful. And I had never thought about that. And she says, well, each time I play that, when I'm answering you, I'm thinking about that. So there were many, many things. And of course, a string quartet is like, you know, especially ones that play together, it's like you're invited into an Amish family. Mm. I mean, they have their own sort of insular language, and you feel like an outsider. So yeah. That was my challenge.
You know, you also play some popular songs such as Shenandoah and Somewhere Over the Rainbow. I want to listen to Stephen Spooner's take on Shenandoah and then ask him why he picked that piece. So why Shenandoah, Stephen?
Well,
it's gorgeous.
Thank you.
Yeah,
it's a touching piece.
Oh my gosh!
You know,
yeah.
But this is to sort of pay an homage to Keith Jarrett, who is one of my favorite pianists of all time.
How could he not be?
Yeah, I mean, the guy is somebody that I would say. I would call him a genius at the piano.
You know, his drummer, Jack DeJohnette, will be in town on Saturday night.
Oh, man.
At the Gem Theater. I just bought tickets this morning.
Oh, my gosh. And their trio that they had with those guys, so fantastic. I mean, I was lucky because I just saw his solo concert at Carnegie was there.
No kidding. No kidding.
At Juilliard. Yeah, it was perfect. So his album, The Melody at Night with You, he plays Shenandoah. And this arrangement is very much, you know, like his arrangement, simple sort of gospel style.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just love his playing.
Now, before you go, I just want to touch on, you received a singular honor earlier this year. You were invited to give a lecture and concert at the Juilliard School. Why was that such an important moment for you?
Well, you know, when you grow up in New Orleans, you're surrounded by jazz. There's there is art music, but it's not our native music, you know. Though America's first pianist is from New Orleans, Gottschalk. But I lost myself in the world of books about pianists and records and things. And one of the most important books is written by David Dubal. It's The Art of the Piano. He also wrote the incredible book about Horowitz, Evening with Horowitz.
Yeah. And he was the one who invited you to New York.
So the very idea that this guy who I've admired, who through his writings, he was the one that made me fall in love with music and the piano and its lore, that he invited me and we had a lecture. I mean, we actually did the lecture together on Horowitz, and I mean, it was really personally significant.
Yeah. Well, the artist is KU piano professor Stephen Spooner. The project is titled Dedications. Boy, I sure enjoyed having you here.
Thank you.
Congratulations on just a terrific project All the best.
Thank you very much.
You best. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about this weekend's March for Science here in Kansas City. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's show, the smart money experts gave suggestions on closing the financial gender gap and budget workouts to get you physically, fiscally fit. Find that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date, or you can go to the NPR One app. Tomorrow, we sit down with two U.S. members of Congress, Democrat Emanuel Cleaver and Republican Kevin Yoder. They're back home from Washington on a recess. They'll be here tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, people march for lots of reasons these days. Here's one that struck us as something a little new and a little different. It's the March for Science taking place on Earth Day this Saturday here in Kansas City and in more than 100 cities across the country. The march will be based in Washington Square Park from 10 a.m. to 2 in the afternoon. Organizers insist the march isn't directed solely at the Trump administration, but there's little question that early decisions the president has made fueled this march. Those decisions include proposed cuts to the National Institutes of Health and the EPA, and the appointment of cabinet members skeptical of climate change. Here to talk about it this morning are two of the event's organizers, Jesse Blakeboro. Jesse, nice to have you. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much, Steve.
Ian Shaker is also here. Good morning, Ian. How are you?
Morning, thanks.
Why a march on Washington?
Well, I think
a march on science, I should say. That's also going to be in Washington. Yeah,
I think the biggest thing is that science has come into question both recently, but especially very recently, and so we want to make sure to put a human face on science. And a lot of the people that are going to be coming are scientists themselves.
You think sometimes science is viewed too abstractly, like it's not really real? It's being done behind closed curtains by people we can't relate to.
I think that there's a lot of question about, you know, where's the money come from, where's the funding come from, who are these people, what's their ulterior motive? And I think the reality is that there are thousands of scientists here within Kansas City and throughout the country who are doing great work, you know, with the scientific method in mind and nothing else.
Jesse, is this event aimed squarely at President Trump?
I don't think so, no. Right now, we are obviously protesting a lot of the policies that have come out of the Trump administration, but it's not solely at Trump. I think that we've seen in the recent years there's been a backlash and a fear when it comes to what we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And in science in particular, it is a murky field, but I also want to make it clear that we're not just scientists that are marching right now. We're science advocates and enthusiasts, and anyone who questions and is interested in practicing and kind of moving all across the board on that. We don't want to exclude anyone.
So this march is more pro-science than anti-Trump, if I'm hearing you right.
Absolutely.
You think your followers believe that too? Because there's a lot of interest on your Facebook page in this thing.
Well, we've done what we believe to be a really good job of trying to make sure that we open up the discussion across both sides of the table, because we are nonpartisan. Science does not have a political affiliation.
Mm-hmm.
Science is science. Facts are facts. And we really need to get back to that, root ourselves in reality.
Hmm. Ian, is this march a march or a rally? You get asked that all the time, don't you?
Officially, it's a rally. And frankly, the reason for that has been cost and logistics. The city of Kansas City won't let us shut down streets and things like that. And so there's the rally. Whether people happen to be marching on the sidewalk heading to the rally, that will be up to them.
What's going to happen at this rally?
We have a number of speakers who are going to be appearing throughout. Most of them are science-based. We do have a couple of politicians who won from each side of the aisle to make sure that we get balance. And the reason that they're there is because they want to focus on science overall. But we'll also have informational booths, both from science-based groups and also from advocacy groups from throughout the area. And we'll also have a kids area where some folks from museums and science-based locations throughout the area are going to be bringing learning and educational information for children.
Jesse, I'm still struck by this notion that science is getting people revved up here. And we were talking about, is this pro or anti-Trump? How about climate change? Is much of this interest being fueled by that issue? And that's what has people so energized here?
Well, climate change definitely falls under the broad umbrella spectrum of what we are protesting, because we believe that climate change is real. The majority of scientists will believe that climate change is real, and it's definitely something that we see in this administration they're stepping away from.
Mm-hmm.
What we're looking forward is to bringing the discussion to Kansas City and making sure that Kansas Cityans are getting their voices heard. That's also one reason why we're really excited at the march itself. We're going to be bringing up our supporters onto the stage, and they're going to be sharing their Why I March, because it is about their voices and our voices and the discussion that's going to happen.
Ian?
I think one of the other things to focus on is that recently, and especially with the 2016 election cycle, us in the Midwest were in some ways, I think, pigeonholed. And I think one of the goals of our specific march, our specific event, is to remind people that we come from all over the spectrum. We're not just those forgotten Midwesterners that we've mm-hmm. all heard so much about. That there are, I mean, there's an incredible tech sector here in the Kansas City area that's yeah. science-based, engineering-based. And so we need to make sure that people are aware of that and that it is heard loud and clear.
You know, there are critics of this march coming up on Saturday. Some are skeptical about what you're trying to do here. One, a geologist writing in the New York Times, said this. He called it a terrible idea, and he wrote, "Trying to recreate the pointedly political women's march will serve only to reinforce the narrative from skeptical conservatives that scientists are an interest group who politicize their data, research, and findings for their own ends." What do you say to that?
Well, to that I'd say I believe that the current administration has politicized science from the start by putting gag orders on federal organizations, by trying to remove scientific data from government websites. That is a political move. And what we're looking to do is to voice the concerns on the people who are concerned on that behalf. We are nervous. We're living in a world right now where there are alternative facts, and science is not an alternative fact.
I was going to say, you guys are coming along at a time when there's so much skepticism about so much of society, what I do for a living, being a reporter, you know, police officers, everything. And you guys are running right into the face of that, trying to support scientists.
Well, and I think, you know, the two of us here, of our organizers, two of us are scientists, and two of us are, Jesse's a social scientist, but I'm not a scientist. I'm a former journalist who feels like this is something that needs to be talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the fact that we're talking about science and having to discuss the veracity of such things, whether it be journalism or science, is, I think, scary is a good word for it.
And you feel like you're pushing against a tidal wave here of skepticism out there that a march on Saturday isn't really going to be able to counteract?
No, I think what we're really pushing against is we're not pushing against anything, to be honest with you. I think what we're trying to do is reinforce with people what they really know in their minds. We've all been taught from the time we were in kindergarten that, you know, things, we all had our lava science fair, mm-hmm. you know, science fair projects. And what we're doing is we're trying to remind people that that doesn't stop when you become a political animal as an adult.
Yeah, Jesse.
Yeah, especially we are trying to really get it out there that science is accessible, because it should be, and it is. Science affects you whether you believe in it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just trying to remind people how it does touch their lives.
So how does the march on Saturday in Kansas City connect with the national event, the national march taking place in Washington? Is there a connection between these two things? Are you getting help or advice or support from a national group that might exist out there?
Well, to be honest, Steve, we haven't necessarily been able to spend as much time as I thought we would have with the national campaign. We are the official affiliate. The Kansas City March is with the National March in D.C. They've given us a few guidelines, but for the most part, this really has been a grassroots Kansas City. Just a few of us really pushing to get this through because it matters right now. What we say matters, and our actions matter, and we hope to see that on Saturday.
Are you guys looking for members of Congress, two of whom will be here later in the week? Do you want them to get a message from this and act upon something when they go back to Washington again?
I think they're already hearing it mm-hmm. organically through social media. I think that's part of the culture that we're in right now. what we want to make sure is to provide some clarity to that and to provide really we've talked about this a number of times, that put a face with who these people where this is coming from.
Now, Jesse, once you push past climate change, are there other issues out there, other things happening that are being overlooked these days that you'd like to see emphasized more?
I definitely think that there's a wide range of topics that people don't necessarily associate with science, like social science goes a lot into psychology. And in that, I'm particularly interested in substance abuse. I believe that we need to have more funding to look into different ways to kind of solve that problem, problem solve substance abuse, and look into really what goes into the causes of it.
I think one of the biggest things that people lose sight of is, as Jesse said, you know, we're having a healthcare discussion in this country. Well, healthcare and the cost of healthcare related to new drugs, new cures, those are all science.
All that
related.
Plays into this. Yeah,
exactly. So it's not just about one policy. It's about the broader issue.
You've got more than 1,800 people who have indicated on Facebook that they're going to the rally on Saturday. 3,300 people indicated they were interested. Does that go beyond what you were expecting?
I think our dream goal was about 2,500 people. I think we're going, I'm hopeful that we're going to hit that, and we probably, I would love to think that we're going to break through that.
So what time should people show up who are listening? If it's between 10 and 2, is there a sweet spot that might be the more interesting time to come on Saturday?
Well, obviously we would say that all of it's going to be amazing.
Yeah.
But I think what we're trying to do is provide people with opportunities to come in and out of it. So if they show up at 9:30, some of the booths are already going to be set up by that point. Our first speaker will be at 10 o'clock, and then we're trying to space things out so that there are opportunities for people to really visit everything that we have to offer there.
How would you like to see, Jesse, lawmakers get involved with scientists? Is there anything else you'd like to see happen out there?
At the march specifically?
At the march or just in general?
Well, at the march, I would love to see some of our congressmen come out. We know they're going to be back home, and I would love for them to come and witness their constituents and what they have to say and their concerns. As for after the march, we actually are working with National to have a week of action, people that we're going to call, causes that we're going to support. And that list is still being finalized by National, so unfortunately we don't have anything to share at this time, but we are not done after Saturday. It's really only just begun.
The March for Science takes place from 10 to 2 on Saturday in Washington Square Park in downtown Kansas City. That's by Crown Center. I want to thank Jesse Blakeborough and Ian Shaycare. Shaycare, am I saying that right?
You are.
Shaycare, for coming in today and talking about what's coming up this weekend. Thank you all very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Now it's time for State House Blend Missouri, where this week host Brian Ellison dug deeper into questions recently raised on the podcast about allegations of pay for play.
Questions especially about a bill introduced by the Missouri Senate President Pro Tem, Ron Richard, and campaign contributions, including $100,000 6 days after the bill was introduced, from David Humphreys, whose company might stand to benefit from the bill. It was Representative Mark Ellerbrock, a Democrat, who first raised this with us 3 weeks ago at a live taping in Liberty. He'd written an open letter earlier to Richard in March, and he was more than happy to tell us about it.
We got a President Pro Tem of the Senate that took $100,000 5 days after he dropped a bill that would basically excuse his largest donor from a lawsuit.
You know, I want to pursue your suggestion that the President Pro Tem of the Senate, Ron Richard, is
crook.
You tweeted today at me.
Yeah.
You said a tweet that said, "Ask me why Ron Richard is a crook."
I'll tell you why.
So I'm asking.
All right. Hold on a second. Let me get my evidence. So there was a lawsuit that was filed against David Humphreys, or Tamco, I should say. He's the CEO of Tamco. Now, Tamco makes shingles, and they're involved in a class action lawsuit. So there's a case. It's number 14AO-CC00110. It was filed on April 15th, 2014, the next legislative cycle. Ron Richard filed a bill that would basically undo the law that they were using to sue David Humphreys and Tamco, right? And it hadn't been filed ever before.
This week on the podcast, I asked David Hudnall, a staff writer for The Pitch who's been reporting on this, To help us understand it, beginning with the details of that case against Tamco Building Products.
In 2014, there was a class action lawsuit filed against Tamco. There's two plaintiffs. Basically, they have the same claim, which is that they bought Tamco shingles and they have a 30-year warranty, but after 5, 6, 7, 8 years, they started rotting and warping and were defective. And so both of those parties filed a warranty claim with Tamco saying, you know, we want our shingle, you know, we want a replacement on these shingles. In one of the cases, Tamco gave a partial replacement. The other one, Tamco denied the warranty claim. So this lawyer in St. Louis put these two together and filed the class action suit. And Tamco responds by saying, you can't file a suit against us because on the packaging of the shingles you bought in itty-bitty fine print, it says any warranty disputes have to be settled in arbitration. Arbitration is private, so in theory, Tamco could be settling thousands of these suits privately and nobody would ever know. And also, like anecdotally, plaintiffs' attorneys will say that plaintiffs are less likely to come out ahead in these in those arrangements. So
they file a class action suit, and this is how Tamco wants to resolve it. The plaintiffs don't go for that, and the court decides what?
They side in the favor of the plaintiffs. They say, no, this case can go ahead. And so then Tamco appeals it to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals says the same thing. They're like, you know, just because you write on the packaging that doesn't make it a binding agreement. And so then they skip it up to the United States Supreme Court, and that's kind of where it is right now. It's kind of in limbo. It's sort of pending. It's unclear of like, you know, if they're going to take it up or what.
The court's accepting arguments on whether they should take it up at this
point.
And the case has not gone to trial on the merits at all.
No.
All right. So that's what's going on with the case. But let's talk about what Senate Bill 5 would do. Senate Bill 5 is what it's called in this year's session, since it was submitted, pre-filed back in December by Senator Ron Richard. What do we know about sort of the sequence of events from the time that it was the donation was received and the bill was filed?
Ron Richard is the Senate leader in Missouri, and he got a $100,000 check from Humphreys during the last campaign cycle. He was not running, but he still got a $100,000 check.
So you're talking about back in June, he got $100,000.
Yes, June. In December, when legislators start pre-filing bills, he pretty quickly filed SB 5, which is like Albrecht was alluding to, is sort of designed to gut the Consumer Protection Act in Missouri, which is called the Merchandising Practices Act. So one of the things that this bill has, that Richard's bill has, is that you would not be able to sue a company under the MPA if that company is already regulated by a state or federal agency. So
aren't a lot of companies regulated
by a state?
Basically,
that includes
agency?
Every company in the world or in the state.
Okay, so that was on December 1st that he pre-files the bill. When's this donation come in?
So then he gets another $100,000 check from Humphreys about 5 or 6 days later.
Yeah, December 7th.
December 7th. And then that happens to be the day before new campaign finance law limits went into effect. So he sort of just got it in under the wire.
Is it clear what the impact of Senate Bill 5, if it were to pass, would be on this pending case against Tamco?
Yeah, so it is also fairly technical from a legal point of view, but it would retroactively allow for procedural changes in that case. So essentially, Tamco could probably file a motion if this passed afterwards saying, you know, there are these new burdens of proof that the plaintiffs must meet, and those new burdens of proof would be very difficult to meet. And so, you know, if they couldn't meet those, then the judge could dismiss the suit. So basically, it would allow them legal maneuvering to increase their chances of dismissing the suit.
Now, after we reported on all this, we did get a letter from Humphrey's attorney, Joe Rebine. He told us the statements linking Humphrey's to the bill filed by Senator Richard were false and defamatory. He points out in his letter that Humphrey supports many candidates, that such activities are his constitutional right, even his civic responsibility, and that many people who are not David Humphrey's did support Senate Bill 5. The lawyer was responding not only to Ellenbrock, but also to Senator Ryan Silvey, who we had on the podcast a couple weeks later. Silvey didn't claim knowledge of anything illegal, but he said he thought Ellenbrock's allegations were worthy of some consideration or investigation. He said he didn't think anybody would be surprised if somebody wanted to look into it. And he also went further, suggesting that Senate leadership, his fellow Republicans, exhibited a pattern of assigning bills to committees and prioritizing issues based on who made significant financial contributions.
I think that, again, the way that they have ordered the calendar, the way that if you look at how bills have been handled, there are approximately 60 bills this session that were referred to different committees last year than they were referred to this year. And several of them, it would be questionable as to whether the committee they were sent to was the appropriate committee of jurisdiction or if it was sent there because of who the chairman was and how the leadership would anticipate the chairman would handle that bill. I don't think that's how the Senate's supposed to operate, and I have been critical of it, and I think rightfully so.
Is that coming at a cost to you?
Well, I'm not chairman of appropriations, so I think it probably is. I've had one bill on the calendar, so it probably has.
So no other Republicans have joined Senator Silvey in publicly questioning Richard's actions on this, which led me to ask David Hudnall of The Pitch, is this really pay to play?
Well, I think the conclusion is that there's a lot of good questions to be asked of the way, you know, Republicans are running the Missouri legislature. But I think it requires, you know, a shift in power to actually enact any changes to the way that things go down there.
So not asking you to show all your cards or anything as a reporter, but I mean, what are the next steps in something like this? If no other legislators are speaking up about it, what does further reporting or investigating on something like this look like?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, you know, short of, you know, a phone call, a tapped phone call where somebody says, yeah, do this and I'll write you this check. I'm not sure what more you can ask, you know, what more you can find on an issue like this. That's kind of the issue.
I want to end with words from Mark Ellerbrock's letter. It's how he ends the letter. He says, he's writing to Ron Richard. If you decline to publicly clear the air concerning the connection between Mr. Humphrey's contributions and your pursuit of legislation favorable to his interests, Missourians naturally will conclude that you have something to hide. Will Missourians actually conclude that, or are reporters like yourself the only ones worried?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very interesting question. It's like, does this cost Ron? I mean, Ron Richard isn't even running for re-election, so, but like, let's say that he was, would his constituents really care about this stuff? Are they even hearing this news? You know, everything is so fragmented in terms of the media these days that you kind of wonder, like, what would it take to get, you know, some of these lifelong Republican voters to see this situation for what it is and change their votes? And I don't have the answer to that question, but I think it's an interesting question.
A question that perhaps we haven't heard the last of. David Hudnall is a staff writer for The Pitch. David, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Brian.
Statehouse Blend Missouri is produced by Matt Hodapp. I'm Brian Ellison. Thanks for listening.
That was from KCUR Statehouse Blend Missouri podcast. To hear the full conversation, subscribe to the show wherever you get our podcasts or on the NPR One app. You can download our podcasts and listen to previous programs. Just go to kcur.org/uptodate. Follow us on Twitter. We're at @KCURUpToDate. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. On tomorrow's program, Republican Kevin Yoder and Democrat Emanuel Cleaver, two members of Congress, discuss recent goings-on in the U.S. House of Representatives. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tatacoro. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.